Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah. Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to the Wisden Cricket Weekly Podcast. Lots, as always, to talk about in today's show. We'll be looking back at the first three T20Is of the India-England series, revelling in Mark Wood's superb outings with the ball, Josh Butler's runs at the top of the order, an eventful week in the Caribbean, some news from the Shires and much more. I'm Yaz Rana, and to talk through all that with me is the managing editor of Wisden.com, Ben Gardner, and the magazine editor of Wisden Cricket Monthly, Joe Harmon. There's a new issue that goes to print today and comes out next week. So let's start in India. England are 2-1 up with two games to play. And Joe, arguably the biggest positive for England thus far has been the performances of Mark Wood, who took 1 for 20 from 4 overs in the opener, missed a second with a niggle and took 3 for 31 in the third T20I.
Yeah, it's been fantastic to watch, and there's always those concerns when you hear that Mark Wood couldn't play the second game. You think, oh no, has he been crocked again? And then to bowl like he did in that third match, which was just kind of eye-wateringly quick. It's just fantastic to watch, and it's so good. He had a bit of a miserable time in the test series, and he didn't play. He just sat around, went home, came back. So it's great to see him doing really what he does best now. And I think that's quite an interesting question over the next months. By bowling this well in T20s, is he actually harming his test chances? Because we've seen that England are prioritising, or certainly deciding, which players suit which formats at which times. And Mark Wood, you'd have to say, is much more valuable to England's T20 World Cup prospects than he is to their test summer, I would say. That's not to say he can't play any test cricket, but I don't think we'll see a lot of him in test cricket this summer. And I think he'll be kind of wrapped in cotton wool to an extent ahead of that T20 World Cup.
Yeah, I think that's fine though, personally. I mean,
you might do, he might not.
Well, yeah, but I think he should see it as a bit of a bonus, because he's never been as effective in England as he has been overseas. I think there's a real chance for him this winter to go and bowl England very quickly to a T20 World Cup, and then to go on an Ashes tour, where even if he plays throughout the five games, he could well play a huge part in that as well. I think that England would be absolutely right to, I mean, even if they decide that he's very important for that Ashes series, I still think that, like, I don't know what you gain from bowling Mark Wood in England when we have so many bowlers who are so effective here, and Ollie Stone, who's come as sort of like a pace option as well. I think if England want a pace option, they should go with Stone or Archer, and just, I think it'd be absolutely right to leave Wood to one side for the moment, I think.
I don't disagree. I just think it is hard to say, Mark Wood, you played two tests this year, now go and win us the Ashes. And I think that's a tricky thing to do. The thing is, with Wood, he has shown before that he can come from seemingly nowhere, like he did in the Caribbean a couple of years ago, and bowl at the speed of light and win a test match for England. But yeah, I think I agree. I think that is how they handle him, and it's no reflection on him. And it might well secure him a pretty lucrative IPL deal come this time next year, which you kind of feel like he deserves given the career he's had.
Is it kind of fair that this is kind of snuck up on us that how important Mark Wood is to England's T20 side. I don't think people really have been talking about that much. I know you can kind of split Wood's career almost pre-St Lucia test and post-St Lucia test, but he's we're looking today and he's barely played much T20 cricket in the last 4 years, 19 games since the start of 2017, and for reference, Chris Jordan has played well over 100. But now he's kind of at a level that people have thought that he bowls really quickly and he's a better bowler than he was in the past, but this series he's almost at another level completely. Like the delivery to get rid of KL Rahul, 90 mile per hour coming into him, completely getting through one of the best T20 players in the world. Like he's really pivotal to this England side success.
Yeah. So we had Ben Jones of Cricviz write a piece about Mark Wood for the website today. And he's bowled, in the last year, he's bowled four of the fastest six spells by an England bowler in T20I cricket. And two of those have come in this series. So he's bowling seriously quickly. And I think that's a lot has been made of, which we'll come on to later, the toss in this series. But you saw how much England missed him in that second game as well. I mean, as much as I think England actually did okay with the bat, even though they were struggling to get up to 164 or whatever it was. But then Tom Curran especially looked like he struggled with the ball and they didn't have that same penetration up the top, and then India just knocked off the runs fairly easily after that. And so, and yeah, one of England's defining problems with their T20 side has been power play wickets, and Wood seems to have answered that pretty emphatically. And that he's doing on these kind of wickets as well, which haven't been the quickest really. Actually, it's almost been the opposite is the issue. England really struggled for their timing, that he is still coming in and like blowing batsmen away is remarkable really.
But I think you're right, Yaz. I think it has crept up on us a little bit, because I'd certainly remember us talking on this podcast about Mark Wood as a T20 bowler and us questioning whether he has the kind of skills for the format. But the way he's bowling it's kind of almost obsolete. If he's going to bowl that quick and he's got such good control of line and length and he's got a clearly defined role in that side, then he doesn't really need three different types of slower ball in the way that someone like Tom Curran absolutely does. So I think it has come and surprised us. And I think you also see, when you watch Wood and Archer in tandem, as they were in that third match in particular, you just think these two have got to play and they've got to be bowling together at certain times as well, because it just makes life so hard for batsmen. And suddenly England's seam attack, which has looked a little bit kind of pedestrian at times, now looks really threatening kind of throughout the innings. And obviously you've got Adil Rashid up your sleeve, who's now bowling with a new ball as well as in the middle and doing a fantastic job of both.
I think Wood's success kind of reminds me of Norkia in the IPL. He didn't really have a reputation for being a gun T20 bowler, but I guess when you bowl that quick, it is quite simple. If you bowl 92 miles per hour consistently, which Wood pretty much averaged in the first T20I, it's just quite hard for pretty much every batsman, other than maybe Virat Kohli, to deal with. I think it's quite interesting that Rashid's being used in the power play, because I think, Joe, you're right. If you look through the innings, you kind of see England almost a fine in each phase of the innings in a way they probably weren't that recently, with now Rashid, Archer and Wood in the power play, Wood in the middle overs. You kind of got Stokes, Curran and Jordan a little bit in the middle, and then Jordan and Archer towards the end. It kind of feels like they have most, if not all, bases covered with the ball, with their first choice seam attack.
Yeah, the question will be, when they come up against a surface that, you know, turns significantly, which none of these have yet, or not even significantly, but just enough that makes a spinner much more effective than a seamer. Like in this series, the teams have gone in with two very different attacks, with India often having three spinners in England, just the one in Rashid. And it's, I wonder if Moeen will get, I hope he will get a run out in the fourth or fifth game, just so that you kind of see where he is, basically. But if England don't have that sort of, that second spinner that they can really rely on. I remember in the 2016 World T20, there was a game where New Zealand played India, and New Zealand basically beat India at their own game, I think, picking three or four spinners. I think
Sodhi took quite a few wickets, didn't he?
Mitch Santner bowled really well as well. Yeah. And that can happen in a global tournament. That's almost where you come up with against a greater variety of surfaces. And I think that's the base England don't have covered. They have their first choice game plan will work on a lot of surfaces, but I don't think they yet are absolutely certain that they can sort of like adapt to the more sluggish wickets, especially the wickets that turn with that attack. I think that's the question.
It is interesting that we're three matches into the series and we haven't seen Moeen Ali, because when England were winning in South Africa, we're saying, well, this is great, they're playing fantastically, but this obviously can't really be the side that wins the T20 World Cup in India, because they've only got the one spinner And they haven't really got a part-time spin option there if Root's not going to play, which seems likely. But now we're 3 matches into an India series and England are going well without Mo and Ali. And now suddenly you're thinking, well, they wouldn't be playing this side if they have no intention of playing it come the T20 World Cup. So actually, perhaps this is just their first choice team. That's not to say you don't need that second spinner, and you might possibly need that third if we do come across the kind of pitches that you might well do in a tournament. But it does seem that they have landed upon this side and thought, well, this is the side that suits us. It goes against the grain in T20 cricket, where spin is so important, but England play to their strengths, and that's what they've done so far.
I think the fact that the whole series is being played at one venue is quite important. Like, we're not learning that much about what conditions are going to be like in all of India. And it's also a venue that hasn't had any international T20 cricket at before. And also, it's not based on much, but I do wonder if you kind of see a lot of spin in T20 cricket because, like, kind of 6 out of 10 spin is better than 6 out of 10 pace. But if you actually got, like, 4 gun quicks who do different things, does actually that attack is almost more well-rounded. That is interesting. We kind of touched upon Tom Curran a little bit already, but, and I know he only bowled 2 overs and he's not played a whole lot of cricket recently, but his position in the squad is under a bit of threat, do you think, Ben? He's not gone great for England recently in T20 cricket. I know he's won games for England in the past. He didn't have a great IPL either. And there are players outside the squad who could feasibly offer a bit more than he has recently.
Yeah, I think, you know, there's a long time to go between now and that T20 World Cup. And he obviously, you know, it was just 2 overs, so you can't read too much into it. And I think England do have a lot of faith in him. And it goes back really to that ODI when he sort of made his name just after the Ashes, when he took 5 wickets. England were defending like sort of like a nip and tuck 280 plays 275 sort of game. And he really sort of stood up then and looked like a bowler who had the mettle for international cricket and knew how he could, like, sort of second guess batsman with his variation, that sort of thing. So I think that he still does have some faith, and it goes back as far as that. England do have options that they can, you know, that could feasibly overtake him. I mean, Rhys Topley is in the squad. I think it'd be interesting to see how he went. He offers off a different angle. He's a little bit quicker than Curran, even though he doesn't have the same, struggle with injuries. He doesn't have the same experience recently in terms of how much he's just played in T20 cricket. Tamal Mills is someone who I think the numbers geeks rate as one of the best death bowlers in the world, actually, in terms of his economy towards the end of the innings, but hasn't had much of a go with England since, I think, 2017 was his last game for England. So he is also one. I mean, I guess the thing with Tom Curran is he is a death bowler, but I think they kind of think maybe he can do a few different roles, whereas Mills is very much a specialist death bowler, so he does offer you something more well-rounded. But I think he's under a bit of pressure, but there is a lot of time for him to sort of get it right between now and then, even if he doesn't play much in the IPL, have a season in the nets with those bowling at those batsmen and playing with those coaches and stuff. So that will that could well help. So I don't think it's I think there is a bit of pressure on him, and it is interesting how his stock has fallen from him being almost first choice before the World Cup, before Archer's emergence, to where he is now. But I don't think it's at the point yet where we're sort of, you know, writing obituaries for Archer's for Curran's England career. But yeah, a little bit of pressure, I suppose.
Zaki Mahmood is the one for me. I mean, Tamal Mills is kind of tantalising, but his fitness issues mean that it's hard to necessarily bank on him. I think he's going to get enough cricket in before that tournament, but he's certainly an exciting prospect. But Zaki Mahmood, I think I've seen highlights of him bowling at the PSL. He swings it late. I also think he's got a higher ceiling than Tom Curran. I think the thing they like a lot about Tom Curran, and you can see it just in the way he plays, he's got this kind of big match, big moment temperament. He wants the ball when things are tough. And you can see why Owen Morgan loves that in him. But he does look quite hittable sometimes. It looks like batsmen can get into a rhythm against him. And it sometimes it looks like he doesn't have really anywhere to go. And I think that's partly a lack of pace at times. He's got lots of good slow ball variations, but it does seem like batsmen can read those quite often. So I think he is a bit under a bit of pressure. But he does also offer more with the bat. He's not going to be batting high in this side, but those lower order runs, he's obviously got that in favour over Zaki Mahmood. But I think over the next few months, Zaki Mahmood is the one that I would be watching as potentially going to leapfrog Tom Curran.
He does the same thing with the bat as well. He's like a, you know, his statistics might not leap out of the page as a batsman in T20 cricket, but you've seen it for Surrey, where there's been sort of real sort of crunch moments in games or when his team's been really under the pump, that's when he tends to step up. So there is a lot to like about him as a cricketer, I think. And it's kind of, it's almost like there's lots of reasons to like him beyond his skill set, which is actually the thing that's lacking. It's the question of if that can outweigh the fact that there's bowlers who on paper look better, I guess.
So. Yeah, I would contest that you don't need to have access to the Cricviz database to be excited by Tamar Mills. but I think it's what will be interesting over the next, I don't know, what, 6-7 months before the World Cup is, let's say England win this series 3-2-4-1, whatever. They don't have that many games before the World Cup proper preparation really starts in October later this year. So I wonder how much emphasis they'll put on strong performances in the T20 Blast and particularly the 100 for players like Tamar Mills or Saqib Mahmood who aren't playing in the IPL. Like, will, if one of those two guys has a gun tournament, would they... I guess it is somewhat of a risk because they've not actually played that much for England recently. I wonder if that will happen because there aren't that many opportunities between the 100 and the World Cup starting for those guys to play for England.
Yeah, we know how much stock Morgan puts in trust and knowing players and knowing them as personalities as well as cricketers, really. So I think anyone who's not part of the group now is going to be hard pushed to get into it, really, particularly when you think of the talent they've got. Saqib Mahmood is a bit different because he has been part of that setup. He's played 50 over and T20 cricket for England. Morgan knows him well. I think the idea that someone is going to have such a brilliant 100 or maybe even T20 blast and then gets parachuted into squad, I think is probably going to be, it's kind of England of the old days, isn't it? And actually, they're in such a strong position. They don't really need that to happen now. I think it would only mean very slight adjustments among the group that we've already got.
Yeah, the only thing I would say is when you're looking for the 15th player in a 15, that sometimes I think you can get just a little bit more leeway. So just looking back to the last World T20, Liam Dawson was picked for that squad, having not played a professional game for England at that point. So I think, and I guess the difference between now and then is how seriously England take the format, I guess, and also just how good England are at white ball cricket overall. But and I guess the other thing as well is that there's more names than we've mentioned even then. You know, Pat Brown looked like a bowler who coped with international cricket in New Zealand and has struggled with injury since, but he's clearly highly rated, clearly got a lot of skills, and that's could work in his favour. Someone like Matt Parkinson as well, again, didn't look overawed, just like bring something different as a leg spinner who bowls it slowly and really rips it. That could be very valuable on a pitch that is spinning because he'll get the most out of it. I think that there's...
Reece Topley's in the squad.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, I think that there are a lot of players who will be thinking that, but I think Joe is right that there is, it's a different scenario now, but I think the players at least will still be thinking a good 100 and maybe open the shout. And also, there's another T20 World Cup next year, so even if you're not in it for this one, then...
And actually, I would add, sorry to slightly contradict myself, I do think that spin, it's a bit different for the spinners because there is that dearth of spin options. Someone like Danny Briggs, who I think was a backup for this tour, is that right? He was called up as a backup recently.
Yeah, I don't think he's there, but he's one of the backups.
Yeah, he's obviously played for them before, but not under Morgan. He's someone who you could see potentially coming into, or even someone like Dan Moriarty at Surrey, that would be a real bolter. But I think that there is that dearth of spin options, that is the area where you could see someone potentially coming from nowhere.
Or Liam Dawson just takes his normal spot on an England squad without playing between each tournament.
It's
as well.
Probably more likely. Yeah.
There was quite a lot of chat on Sky about how much of an advantage it is chasing in T20 cricket, particularly in day-night games in the subcontinent. All three games in the series so far have been won by the side chasing. The recent PSL was dominated by sides chasing, and Nasser Hussain had quite an interesting analogy to explain why, because he basically said, like, imagine playing beach cricket, and if it's really dry, the ball doesn't come onto the bat at all, but if the tide comes in, makes it damp, suddenly the ball really skids through. And he said that's kind of what happens with the dew. And he used the example of the second T20I where England really struggled to time the ball in when they batted first, but it was fine for India. I'm not convinced that in that 15 minute innings break it completely changes, but it is interesting, and the stats kind of show that it has been quite a big advantage recently. Michael Atherton suggested that you could have a situation where to kind of get around the advantage of batting second, one side bats for 10 overs, the second side bats for has their full innings of 20 overs, and the side that batted first then has 10 overs at the very end. What do you reckon about that?
I think it's probably slightly too much of an alteration for me.
Coming
I think
from you, Ben. You love an alteration.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that would take it, that make a game take quite a long time. I think first of all, if you have two innings breaks rather than one, I'll say, you know, that team that have the split innings, I think would probably still struggle in terms of, you know, you've got a batsman who's set. I mean, imagine Dave Miller having to take score 20 off 20 twice before he can accelerate. That would be a tough thing. I think that's a little bit extreme. But, you know, I mean, if this does become a huge dominant thing, I think they showed this out something like 65-35, which is a big split, but I don't think it's...
That's not too much, is it?
I
think quite a lot. That's like double your chance of winning if you bat second.
Yeah. But then the toss is an important thing in cricket. It always has been. I think we don't need to start changing that necessarily. I think if the trend got worse than that, it perhaps would need looking at. And if you're saying it's often specific to this part of the world where the dew becomes such a factor, it would be a shame if we had a World Cup where it got to the point where we're talking 80-85% of teams batting second win. Mm. Because it is such an open tournament, and we think England and India are perhaps a bit better than the rest, but not much. It's all pretty even. So it would be a shame if it was really the toss that was determining those matches between some quite kind of equal sides.
You had a pretty wacky solution.
Yeah, well, I have to be honest, I haven't really looked into it in huge detail, but something that I've seen suggested is sort of like you replace the toss with sort of a bidding system where each captain sort of says they'll concede 15 runs or have many runs for the option of bowling first or batting first, whichever they'd rather do. And then whoever has the higher bid gets their choice, but the other side get that sort of bonus, which I guess is, you know, the captains couldn't complain in that situation because it is something that they've absolutely agreed to in terms of if you lose because of that extra bit of runs, well, that's what you said, that's what you thought it was worth. It's a bit fiddly, possibly. It's a bit sort of hard to explain to a newbie for a sport that's already having
it's
to deal
really
with that.
Not really fitting that kind of what you want for T20 to make it nice and easy and simple for everyone to understand.
Yeah,
it?
but you know, the BBO has this bat flip because they have sort of like some sort of funky envelope thing that makes it look all glamorous. And then, you know, I mean, people watch Deal or No Deal, which is just people opening boxes. This is just that, but the start of a cricket match.
And would this kind of bartering that you describe sort of take place at the middle where you've got Ian Bishop and you've got the two captains?
I think so, because it's just a closed envelope thing. So you just come in with your closed envelope, you each hand it to Ian Bishop.
Deal or No Deal.
Exactly, yeah. And then he opens it and says, and Owen Morgan's bid 15 runs and Kohli's bid 17 runs. India will be batting
second. And that sounds
like
quite a good game in itself without playing cricket after it.
Yeah, maybe they should use it for the 100. On England's batting, Jason Roy has returned to some sort of form. Butler scored a career best T20I score in the third game. The where should Butler bat debate has pretty much ended, basically because he averages 50 there, has 750s in 17 games. But Ben, did we see the risk of opening with Butler in the second game with Stokes struggling to get going towards the end of the innings at number six? Stokes and Butler do basically bat the other way around in the IPL for Rajasthan Royals.
Yeah, I think it is a tricky one, and you get quite a lot of quite definitive statements made about something that really I don't think there's actually a way to have a correct answer on this, because, you know, every time England lose, it's sort of an argument for why Butler should finish, and every time they win, it's an argument for why he should open, really. I think the because what you have with Butler is quite a unique situation where he's England's best opener and their best finisher, I think.
And sometimes when he opens, he can do both.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and the situation with England is that, you know, if you're an opener, you have more opportunity to influence the game. So if you want to maximise Josh Butler himself, you'd open with him. But England have more opening options. You know, there's Stokes, Bairstow is slightly out of place at number four, possibly. So you'd, in a way, it makes more sense to have a lineup with without Butler opening, so he can sort of float and come in. In the way that, you know, Andre Russell does, AB de Villiers does, you know, not every amazing T20 batsman opens the innings. I think the debate has pretty much ended, not least because it seems that Morgan's pretty settled on that way. And I think you do, because that second T20, I actually, in a way, it was because, you know, it wasn't just Stokes struggling to hit at the end, it was Butler out so early as not just an early wicket, it's an early wicket of Butler, which can give a team a sort of a psychological fillip early on. But if you have him finishing in that situation and England are three or four down, but it's three or four other batsmen, that can still leave just too big a hole for Butler to make up, I think. I don't think, because you have that less opportunity to influence the game as a finisher. If he comes in at, you know, 10 overs in England at 40 for four, then there's only so much even Joss Butler can do. So I think, yeah, and but it's worth dwelling on just how good he was in that third T20I, because Kohli at the halfway stage, everyone was going nuts over Kohli's innings because he'd sort of taken his time to get set and then batted on a completely different surface to anyone else. Joss Butler did that, except he didn't even need to take any time to get set. He was 20 off nine balls. At one point, he was threatening England's fastest ever T20 half century. And on a surface where basically no one else was able to time it at all. He has that ability. I mean, he can score very quickly. He can sort of adapt his game to different surfaces while still scoring quickly. He's an absolute freak, and it showed just why he's one of the best in the world.
Well, there was one of the T20s in the summer where Owen Morgan said after the game that England misread the pitch because of how well Butler batted on it at the start.
Yeah.
And then the rest of the England batting order were trying too hard to get England up to 200 when the pitch wasn't great. I 6 months ago, I thought he should bat in the middle because that's England's weakness and he's so much better than anyone else. But if he's scoring 750s in 17 games, he's just going to win England like 30% of the game just by himself. So
I was also in the save Butler as a finisher camp. But you can't really. It's hard to make that argument given what you see he's doing at the top of the order. I would also add to that as well that Morgan has become such a reliable source of runs in that middle order, and also the way he bats, the way he can find a boundary when the chase is on. We know he's a very cool customer. That helps a lot, really. You've got a kind of almost as good as Butler finisher in the Butler role, the former Butler role. And as you say, when you've got Butler at top, he can do both jobs. He's also just so brilliant at analysing a situation, scripting a chase, which are all brilliant things to do as a finisher, obviously. But they're kind of even more useful when you're open because you can set the tone for the whole thing. And I think where they are now is they've landed at the right place, even though quite a lot of us disagreed with Owen Morgan, which I guess is not for the first time he's been proved right.
I do think though that it's right to question whether England have found Ben Stokes' best role, because I don't think they have, basically. And he struggled. It's interesting because you think he's such a powerful hitter and such a clean ball striker, but he does struggle to do that from ball one, and that's even what we've seen to be honest in all his kind of like defining innings. He couldn't do it in the it's not what we did at Headingley, it's not what we did in the World Cup final. Those were games where he scrapped, and then when he had his eye and he was hitting out, that's kind of always been his method, actually. Obviously, you're not going to be dropping Ben Stokes because he's Ben Stokes, and there's every chance as well that he just improves in that role. I think like this, Ben Stokes was not a brilliant ODI batsman when he started out, but he became one. The same in Test cricket, he wasn't a brilliant Test batsman that he now is. And if he follows that same path in T20 cricket, then England can expect that he can improve, I think. But I would just like to see a little bit more flexibility in terms of the batting order. Like, I almost think that if you're batting first and it's the 20th over, I would almost rather have Sam Curran, possibly even Jofra Archer, walking in to hit sixes from ball one than Ben Stokes. But on the other side, if England were to lose a wicket first or second over, we know that Ben Stokes is a very good T20 opener, and he's good in a way of laying the platform and going big, which means that he can sort of deal with the pressure that comes on if you've lost the early wicket. So I would like him possibly as an option to be promoted in that circumstance. So he's sort of like a floating firefighter in a way, rather than like a finisher who always comes in at number six, come what may, I think.
You're kind of getting in Shane Warne territory there with Archer, Archer ahead of Stokes.
Archer has to bat recklessly, but not aggressively.
That's in reference to a Shane Warne tweet during the day-night test. That is interesting, though. You wrote a piece about how England should use Milan in particular, and you weren't calling for Milan to be dropped. You were saying that if England do lose a really early wicket, Milan, who does take a while to get going, he should have that period later on in the innings when power play runs are actually really important. Get someone like Stokes in at three, then Milan ideally comes in around about the sixth over. So he takes a while to get going in the period of the innings that typically the scoring rate is at its lowest anyway.
Yeah, I mean, there's been a couple of instances recently where, it's worth just emphasising that Milan, obviously, his record as it stands sort of almost, you can't really criticise him in a way, and that's fair enough, and there's a lot of his fans that will say that. His method is sort of established in that he will sort of, you know, start slowly and then accelerate dramatically. But it's, I don't think it's right to criticise him when he gets out on 20 off 20 balls, really, because that is just the way he plays. It's the way he's been successful. It's the way he's kind of always been successful, like in domestic cricket as well. And I think England know that as well. I think they know that that's the type of innings that Milan is going to play, and it is going to, at the moment, it's won them a lot more games than it's sort of hurt them in. The question is yeah, as you say, when he should be doing that. So I think in that second T20I, he was 18 off 18 at the end of the power play. And, you know, everyone struggled on that surface. Jason Roy, I think, was only 20 off 18 at the same point. But Jason Roy was, you know, he was trying to hit boundaries and not managing to. Milan, I think there was a stat from Cricket to show that his attack intent, whatever, was not anywhere near what Jason Roy's was. He was basically trying to do that thing that he was doing and succeeding, but it meant that England ended the power play with sort of a subpar power play score. And there was also a game in South Africa, I think, where he was 19 off 20 maybe at the end of the power play. So there's, it's not asking Milan to change anything. It's not saying that England should, you know, consider leaving Milan out. It's nothing like that. It's just that if England lose a wicket that early on, just put someone at the top of the order who is primed to, you know, when there's pace on the ball and, you know, a new white ball, to take that on and getting off to a flyer, even though they've lost one early. And then ideally Milan can come in, yeah, overs 4, 5, up to 10, take his time to get set, and then really take on the bowlers through the middle of the end, I think. I think it's just, it's a reasonably minor point, but also possibly an important one in a crunch game, I think.
Joe, James asks, isn't it great that the selector sent Moeen home to rest instead of playing the last two tests so he could be fresh for carrying the drinks for the white ball stuff?
I think James is being a bit sarcastic there, isn't he? Yeah, I mean, it's not ideal, certainly. But I don't think you can really say to O'Morgan which side you're going to pick for the first three T20s. Oh, Moeen's not in it, so we're playing for the test series. Unfortunately, that's just not how it plays out. It obviously looks silly, and it is a bit silly that he was missing for those test series. We've done the rest and rotation policy to death. I think this is how it was decided. Moeen wanted to focus on white ball cricket, and you can absolutely see why. And I think I'd expect he would still probably play at least one of the five in this series, as much for kind of humanitarian reasons as anything else, or perhaps political reasons as well. And he's still a big part of England's white ball plans. He is still, by a distance, England's second best spinner, and more often than not, you need two spinners in white ball cricket. So I can see why they've got him for there, even though he is currently warming the bench.
On India, Ishan Kishan was amazing on debut in the second T20I. He scored 56 off 32. KL Rahul has one run in three games. India have mixed up their top six a fair bit already this series. Surya Kumar Yadav made his debut in the second game, didn't bat, dropped a catch, and was then dropped for the third T20I. Arijit asks, there isn't any logical explanation for Kishan not opening and Sky being dropped, is there?
Well, I mean, the explanation is that India made a predetermined decision to leave Rohit Sharma out for the first two games to rest him. And then obviously, well, in terms of his stature within Indian cricket, he obviously comes back in when he's rested and available. And then that means that you then have to rejig the team to accommodate him, which in this case meant that you have Rohit and Rahul, who have been India's preferred openers in T20I cricket, even though they actually haven't opened together all that much. And that means Kishan moves down to number three, and I guess Surya Kumar Yadav is sort of the first in, last in, first out sort of thing. So there is a bit of logic there, even though it is very harsh. But I think that India they've reaped the rewards often of sort of sticking by players for a period of time. So I think that you see that in terms of once you're established, I think it can be hard to find your way out of the team. And that's actually worked for them, I think, with some of their batsmen. So, I mean, Rahane's century at the MCG was the vindication of having stuck with him through some tough times with the bat. The same with, you know, Pujara's had some tough times with the bat where he sort of scored slowly but batted a long time and he's stuck around. And that's kind of their general policy overall. So it's no huge surprise, I think, that happened, even though I think, yeah, Surya Kumar Yadav can feel a little bit hard done by that happened to him, I guess.
India did end up with Vijay Shankar batting for the 50-over World Cup. So I kind of think with India that their biggest enemy is themselves. It is like, I kind of think that like if When I was watching the second T20 game, I thought when Kishan was batting like that, I was like, oh no, if India have actually end up picking their best six batsmen, everyone else is screwed. But yeah, I think I loved watching Kishan bat, but I'd love to see Sky play because he's been so good in the IPL for so long. And he bats with kind of intent is the buzzword in T20 cricket nowadays, but he does bat with more intent than a lot of the other Indian guys at the moment.
Yeah,
don't know if any of you have any opinions on him playing.
Well, it's not so much on him, but it's more the intent thing where sort of that's the buzzword, as you say. But I think it goes a little bit against what India actually value in their T20 batsmen. So Kara Rahul is the obvious example, who 2 years ago was one of the best T20 batsmen on the planet. Really was, you know, scoring hundreds for fun in international cricket, was tearing up the IPL, scoring quickly and consistently. And then last year there was sort of like a marked change in his approach, and he actually acknowledged it in interviews. He said, you know, strike rate isn't the be all and end all, like it's about winning games sort of thing. But you're sort of wondering, like, what, where has this come from, essentially, from a batsman who used to score so freely and seemed that, like, you know, all he was focused on was like trying to maximize every possible ball. And it feels like that has probably come from within the Indian team and the way that they value consistency. And the difference between once you're in the setup, you're in, is that if you're trying to get in, you can often be treated quite harshly. So Sanju Samson will be an example of that, who, like, you know, he batted as he has done in the IPL in Australia and came out, tried to score from ball one, had a couple of failures, had one okay knock, I think, and then was left out, even though, you know, that was presumably the job he was picked to do, and that's what he did. And the same, you've seen that with Rishabh Pant, you know, being left out of the T20 squads. I think that they do shoot themselves in the foot a little bit, not only with selection, but with how they ask those players to play once selection and the measure they send by who they select.
On the intent of the batsman, do you think there is such competition for places in Indian batting that it might actually dictate the way some of these players play as well, that they don't feel they can just go and smash 15 off four balls and then actually that's not too bad a job because they're just trying to justify their place in the side with looking at more old-fashioned things like average, or, and that actually means that they're not that they're playing selfishly, but they're kind of looking over their shoulder, particularly if actually that's the way the captain Kohli often goes about his batting in T20 cricket as well.
Well, I think part of the issue is in the IPL teams don't have the batting depth that top international sides have. So if you're batting the IPL, it is much more understandable for someone who's batting the top three to take their time, because for a lot of teams they just don't have the batsmen at 5, 6 or 7 who can really trust to finish an innings against world-class bowlers. Whereas with India's first choice T20 side, I know Ravi Jadeja is not there at the moment, but they could potentially have like Pandya at 6, Jadeja at 7, batting slowly and not giving those guys enough balls at the end is not good. But if you're playing in the IPL, that is fine, because not many teams have that depth.
Yeah, I also think it's an effective ODI cricket as well, where India's game plan in ODI cricket has rightly been skewed towards batting reasonably big and backing their bowlers to defend it, because their ODI attack has been so well set up for that. I mean, at the time when they had Chahal and Kuldeep Yadav bowling wrist spin and Bumrah and Shami sort of leading the seam attack, that's, you know, two properly gun quicks who are going to take loads of wickets, and spinners who are going to do the same. And none of them can really bat, so that means you're right to sort of aim for 320 and back your bowlers to defend it. In T20 cricket, they have, well, Jadeja has now re-emerged as an ODI bowler, but he is a very good T20 player as well, so he gives you that batting depth in T20 cricket, and it's not the same force in their bowling attack in T20 cricket. We should also mention they're missing Bumrah for this series, which is a big miss. But that means that, yeah, they need to aim that little bit higher with the bat because they don't have the same bowling strength. They also have a bit more batting depth, which should allow them to do that. So, yeah, I think, yeah, but the thing is that, you know, you can say that India are struggling with, you know, they're not picking the best side and that sort of thing. If Rohit Sharma or Virat Kohli fires in a World T20 semi-final or final, that's not really going to matter too much. I think even with the team they've picked, they're still one of the favourites. But, yeah, there probably are a few things that, both in terms of their approach and their selection, that could just be a little bit improved, I guess.
Definitely. Before we go on to the rest of the show, a quick message about our online shop. We're relaunching it next month. It'll be bigger and better than ever before, and we'll be hoping that it'll become the go-to place for cricket fans to buy gifts for their friends, teammates and family members. Before the launch, we're running a sale on our commemorative World Cup t-shirts. They're half price at the moment. One of them's got an image of Ben Stokes with his hands in the air after the famous bat deflection at the business end of the World Cup final. That's on the front of the shirt, and there's a list of England's results from the tournament on the back of it. That is half price. You can head to wisden.com /shop to order one for yourself. An update on the pitches that we talked about a fair bit during the test series. The pitches used for the second and third tests of the India-England test series were awarded average ratings by the match referee, thus escaping any sort of punishment. Ben, very quickly, we had a look at how rare below average ratings are dished out. Basically not that often, but there was one quite interesting example from the not too distant past.
Yeah, so when it was mostly Yaz looking at it, to be honest, but most of the pitches have actually been in the Caribbean. It's more been for lack of carry than anything else. The pitches have got below average ratings, but there was a Mirpur surface within the last couple of years that got a below average rating, where it said that from day one there was evidence of the ball breaking the pitch surface, which resulted in uneven bounce throughout the match, along with inconsistent turn, which is even excessive at times. This pitch produced a contest that was too heavily skewed in favour of the bowlers and didn't give the batsmen a fair chance to display their skills. I think some England fans might feel that description could quite easily apply to the Chennai second test pitch and the third test pitch at Ahmedabad, possibly.
Forgive my ignorance, but who actually does the ratings? Is the umpires?
It's the match referee, I think. Referee. So Trevor Gyalesrinath in this case, I think.
Okay.
I think it was David Boone for that one.
Yes, sorry. For the Mirpur one, it's David Boone, yes, but in there.
Nice. I think we'll leave that there.
That's please, yeah.
Moving on. Jason Holder has been replaced as West Indies test captain by Craig Brathwaite. Holder was famously given the job as a 23-year-old and is now replaced by Brathwaite, who led West Indies to that recent series win in Bangladesh. Joe, what do you make of that? It came as a bit of a surprise, I thought.
It did. And when I saw the headline, I thought, who can blame him for stepping down? He's done it for a long time and it's often a bit of a thankless task. And then looking more into it, it's clear that West Indies have made the decision themselves that they think Brathwaite deserves the job, largely on the basis of what West Indies were able to do in Bangladesh with an understrength side, which was very impressive. But it did come as a surprise. I mean, I get the cricket world kind of falls over itself to say what a wonderful leader and captain Jason Holder
is. What a good
man. And what a good man. And I mean, he does seem like all those things. And he obviously led them impressively last year, and English cricket was just so grateful for West Indies to come over here that I think he got a lot of kind of residual credit for that, even though perhaps I don't know how much of it he actually had to do with it himself. But so it's a surprising development. It might not be the worst thing for him. I mean, if he didn't want to lose the job, then it will all smart a bit, I'm sure. But I think he could probably do with a break from that challenge, which is, as I say, not often, doesn't come with a lot of victories, unfortunately, for West Indies cricket. It is surprising that he's been moved aside, but maybe a little bit of renewal at this point is what West Indies cricket needs, what that test team needs.
Yeah, I think that's a lot of that's right, basically. I think that it's worth highlighting he was so young when he got the job, and he'd played fewer than 10 tests, I think, and obviously took it over in such turmoil and did such a good job. Almost like, you know, you get like sort of, they call them turnaround CEOs, is it, I think? When you have a company that's sort of in crisis and then they come in and do a good job of kind of steadying the ship, sort of bringing the fat and whatever. But then actually when it comes to sort of, when you've done that, they're often not the best person to lead you through the next period, I guess. I think West Indies might
like cricket Sam Allardyce.
Yeah, possibly. I think West Indies might well feel that as much as Jason Holder has been a very good figurehead, he's very impressive. He leads the side well in that sense. But that, you know, and there have been impressive victories in that time. Those victories have also been impressive because of how unexpected they've been. And they might well feel that, you know, with an opener like Craig Brathwaite, with, you know, Darren Brough at number four, who's been really good, with Jermaine Blackwood, with, you know, that pace tack is a really, really strong one, that actually West Indies should at this point now be pushing for a little bit more consistency. And maybe it's hard to see the team actually improving under Holder, even though he did steady the ship to begin with. The obvious example to look back is that England series, actually, when West Indies really should have, I know England played the best cricket throughout, but West Indies should have won that because, you know, they played well enough to win the first game. And the second and third, they were only a session or a couple of sessions in each game from winning those. England had to really sort of, you know, race against the clock with both bat and ball to set up positions where they could force the win. And West Indies kind of crumbled. They didn't show much resistance toward the end of those games. Like, I think possibly a more astute captain possibly is able to sort of rouse the team, saying like, just get your heads out. I know we're kind of under the pump, but actually, like, we might be able to just steal a draw here, and then all of a sudden you've got a drawn series, or you've even won one. I think that, yeah, I think that's probably the reason. It's essentially just down purely to the results not improving, and I think it's good that West Indies cricket is in a place where they feel they can make that decision. I think the other thing as well is Craig Brathwaite's much younger than I think we all think he is. He's 28 years old. I sort of thought he was about 32, basically. But he made his name as an 18-year-old.
Yeah. He came in a long time ago. I mean, it's worth another thing with Brathwaite, it's worth mentioning, he hasn't scored a Test 100 for getting over 3 years. He did all right against England last summer, but he came into that series with his place was supposedly under threat because he hasn't scored any runs at all. So that's something to watch. Jason Holder is always going to be in that best West Indies 11. He's always going to be their best bowler. And he's one of the best Test all-rounders in the world. It's not like West Indies are awash with batting options, so you'd think Brathwaite is pretty solid there. But you could see a situation developing where if his current form doesn't pick up and he's also captain, then it starts to become a really heavy burden for him, which was never going to be the issue with Holder. So it is an interesting one to follow, just to see how it goes over the next year or so.
Yeah, I think it shouldn't be underestimated that West Indies win with a weakened side in Bangladesh under Brathwaite was a really, really good win. You know, England didn't win in Bangladesh last time they went. Australia didn't win in Bangladesh the last time they went. It's a hard place to go. So A, it was a really good result. And B, I wonder if our perception of Holder is greater than in other places in the world. In Holder's time as captain, probably the standout result was beating England in the Caribbean in 2019. West Indies have actually done pretty well against England throughout the Holder era. And also, he just got a lot of credit for just kind of getting through the job that he was given as a 23-year-old, which he should.
Which he deserves. A huge amount of sympathy, doesn't he?
Which he deserves, which he deserves. But that doesn't necessarily mean that he's the best person in the world to captain a Test side.
Yeah, I also think just the instant reaction, I think, from a lot of people in England is like, oh, this is West Indies cricket sort of shooting itself in the foot again. I don't think this is that, really. I think you can certainly quibble with the decision for cricketing reasons, and it's certainly fair enough to do that. But I think this is a cricketing decision that's been made rather than, you know, background politics or anything like that. I think that it doesn't seem like that's the case in this instance.
There was an ODI series between West Indies and Sri Lanka in the last week. West Indies won that 3-0. Shea Hope scored millions of runs again, scored 250s and 100. Ben, there was a rare sighting of someone being dismissed for obstructing the field.
Now means there have been 11 players dismissed for obstructing the field in the history of international cricket, so you can make a whole team. Dinushka Gunathilaka opening the batting in the first ODI. It was actually a very exciting start to the series, and it was a good series overall. I mean, the three close-ish games, two well-matched sides, and West Indies deserved winners, but Krumpala took a brilliant caught and bowled, and then this moment where he sort of blocked the ball down into the pitch but wasn't really sure where it had gone, was called through, or was sort of seemed like he was going to run through for a single. His partner sort of ran a long way down and then he sent him back, and then as he was sort of looking around to see where the ball was to sort of get his bearings, he kicks the ball behind him, which stops Pollard getting the ball and means that the batsman at the other end manages to get back in. Kieran Pollard appealed. The TV umpire looked at it, said he was obstructing the field, and gave him out. I think it caused quite a lot of uproar, I'd say, more than you expect from that series, where not many people were watching it in real time. I probably wouldn't have given it out, I think, if I had been the TV umpire, but I think I can see why he did it. I mean, you can see him sort of looking around, and then he does obviously react to the ball just before he kicks it. Maybe it's just his peripheral vision. It's too late for him to get out of the way. But I can see just about how you interpret that, you know, on the balance probabilities as a willful movement. What I did enjoy was the West Indies reaction to the dismissal, which was as if they sort of clean bowled him with a 9 mile per hour Yorker, which was enjoyable. But I think it's good for Kieran Pollard, not long in the job. And I think that in a way, that's sort of what Pollard brings to the role, in that he's such an experienced cricketer and such an experienced cricketer winning tournaments around the world, that he just has that mentality, that sort of win at all cost thing. And that's what he does as a T20 batsman. You know, he comes in late in the innings when things are seemingly lost and then just smashes it out of the park. And this was, you know, him taking an extreme move by appealing for this and then, you know, celebrating wholeheartedly. But that's kind of the attitude that West Indies side needs, I think.
Yeah, I mean, he got a lot of stick for just appealing in the first place, which I thought was unfair. It's like, it's not his decision whether it's out or not. One thing that I found quite interesting from the series was how it impacts the ODI Cricket World Cup.
Super You're angry league. About this, aren't you?
I'm not angry. I feel sorry. I feel sorry for Sri Lanka.
Not angry, just disappointed.
Just disappointed in the injustice of the tournament. So if you don't know about the ODI World Cup Super League...
Where have you been?
Where have you been? B, it's basically how teams qualify for the 2023 World Cup. So seven of those top 13 teams will qualify for the World Cup. The eighth is India, who qualify because they're hosts. But kind of like the World Test Championship, not everyone plays everyone. In the World Test Championship, if you have a slightly harsher set of fixtures, it doesn't really matter because there's no jeopardy for the sides who finish towards the bottom. Whereas here, it can be the difference between qualifying automatically for the World Cup or having to go through the qualifying tournament. Sri Lanka basically just have quite a hard fixture list compared to some of their likely competitors for that eighth, seventh spot. It's kind of a crass measurement, but if you go through each side and see how many series they have against teams that played in the 2019 World Cup, Afghanistan have just five of their eight series against teams that were at the World Cup. Sri Lanka have seven alongside India, actually, and Australia. Sri Lanka also have four series against the world's top five ranked ODI sides. Afghanistan just have two. Afghanistan also have three series against the bottom three sides in the tournament. Sri Lanka just have one. And considering you only need to finish eighth, realistically, to qualify automatically, Afghanistan could feasibly qualify for the World Cup just by thrashing the teams at the bottom. If they win nine games out of nine, that and nicking a couple of other games could see them qualify straight away. And whereas Sri Lanka have to face four of the top five sides in the world, which just doesn't seem that fair. I'm just surprised that that's been given the green light by all the boards involved. That's the most extreme example. There are some less extreme examples in there.
Sri Lanka made any noises about this? Kind of situation, I mean, their fans will suddenly... The problem is, because you and Ben are the only two people in the world that have actually looked ahead at all the fixture schedules, a lot of people won't be aware of this until it actually has already happened. But Sri Lanka fans will start looking at that table over the next few months and who they've got to come and be thinking, well, hang on here, this isn't fair at all. And this is often the problem with cricket. We don't really catch up with the fine detail until it's a little bit too late. And we know from West Indies experience at the last World Cup qualifier just how tough those qualifying tournaments are as well. West Indies snuck through infamously against Scotland when if the downpour had come a bit later, Scotland might have knit them to that position. So we know that if Sri Lanka go through to that qualifier, it's not like they're guaranteed to qualify from that tournament by any means, because there are lots of kind of quite fast developing associate nations who will fancy that.
And you make a good point. This tournament doesn't end until early 2023, so we've got absolutely ages to go. And also, we can't claim to be the first people to work this out. This was evident when the fixtures released over 2 years ago. It's just slightly more stark now, given how given what the current rankings, etc.
And also, this series could hardly have gone worse for Sri Lanka from
that's
that
the thing.
Point of
that's
view. Obviously, West Indies are a team who might well be a rival for that eighth spot come the end of it. And Sri Lanka didn't just not pick up any points. They got a 2-point overrate penalty as well. So after three games played, they're -2, which is pretty bleak for them.
Yeah. It's a long way back from -2.
And Afghanistan have won their first series against Ireland 3-0. Bangladesh, who might be around that spot as well, they won their first series 3-0 against West Indies. So big, big win for West Indies. But I generally quite like the fact that every game really, really matters. I think that third ODI in this series really matters. That could be a really big deal in 2 years down the line. It's just quite hard to really get yourself up for it and kind of see it as a massive World Cup qualifying game when it's 3 years away from the tournament.
Yeah, and the tough thing as well is that when you're in a pandemic, when you know the fixture list gets so squashed, you kind of want a few meaningless games where you can play a second string team. Yeah. And it's just, that has come at just the moment when there are no meaningless games, basically. Because England, actually, are they going to be all right, do you think? Because, I mean, if they were to lose 3-0 to India, then they've only won, what, three of their first nine games. Is that danger time, or is that probably still fine?
I think England will be fine, even if they do lose 3-0 against India. But, yeah, I mean, at least two teams who played the 2019 World Cup will have to go through a qualifying tournament. And Afghanistan finished last in the tournament. They didn't win a game in the 2019 World Cup. And if they qualify, then you have two teams that did okay in the 2019 World Cup having to go through the tournament. So,
but as you said, the boards have all the national boards have ratified this schedule. This isn't as though it was kind of foisted upon them by the ICC. Yeah. And I wonder, there must be a conflict here as well between, on the one hand, not wanting to play the top teams because you want to get as many wins under your belt as possible so you can go to the World Cup. But if you're Sri Lanka wanting to play the top teams, because they're the most lucrative contests in terms of TV broadcasting.
And that's why Australia and India's schedules are so hard, I think, because they wanted that kind of more high-profile fixture list. So, yeah. But I think also we've seen that boards don't always pay attention to the finer details, as we've seen with, you know, various super over deciders and semi-finals deciders as well, if you're England women.
Joe, what's your moment of the week?
My moment of the week was last week, speaking to the ECB's new chairman, or relatively new chairman, Ian Watmore, who I think was announced, last year, but started the job in September. We've been hoping to speak to him for the magazine for a little while, and I got kind of 45 minutes to an hour with him last week. He was just freshly back from a kind of fleeting trip to India for the opening of that enormous stadium out there. And it was an interesting interview. It was an interesting bloke to speak to. He's certainly a departure from what we've seen before in that role, specifically in terms of he's come from outside cricket, as it were, in the three previous ECB chairmen, Colin Graves, Giles Clarke, David Morgan, were all chairman at counties before they got the top job. Ian Watmore is a lifelong fan of the game, grew up supporting Kent, but he's got no background in cricket.
Great CV though.
A great CV, very interesting CV. So, yeah, I mean, for people who don't know much about him, he reported to five different prime ministers during his time as a senior civil servant. He was FA chief executive for just about a year in 2009, 2010, before leaving the job because he was kind of frustrated at the way it was run, and also more broadly frustrated at the way international football was run. And he's been a very successful management consultant, spent 5 years as Accenture's UK managing director. He's also the father of professional footballer, Duncan Watmore, who is at Middlesbrough now, but people might know him from that. He was on the Sunderland documentary, wasn't he? Sunderland Till I Die. And he's also husband to a vicar. So, yeah, there's a lot of points of interest of him. But more to the point was actually just speaking to him. He wouldn't be drawn on any comparisons with Colin Graves when I tried to sort of push him in that direction, which is perfectly understandable. But he did also talk about himself in a way that it was quite clear that he will be a big departure from what has gone before. He talks about wanting to lead in a collaborative rather than dictatorial way. Interestingly, he talked about learning a lot about leadership from his time as a civil servant, from watching how politicians around him operate for the good and for the bad. He says in particular Tony Blair, who, not getting into specific politics, but the way he led in terms of trying to find the centre ground and getting as many people to that place as possible was basically how he wants to lead the ECB. And that obviously is a different approach to Colin Graves, who was very combative and managed to put a lot of noses out of joint in his time as ECB chairman. So look, the proof will be in the pudding, but he's an impressive man to speak to. I found him likeable for what it's worth. I mean, I think that is kind of important given what's gone before. A lot of people found Colin Graves really hard to get on board with. I don't think that's going to be the case with Ian Watmore. And I think getting someone from outside cricket in the way they have, given all that's going on in English cricket in terms of the 100 and this battle for the soul of English cricket, I think having someone come in who hasn't got the perceived biases of being at a specific county before was a really smart move. And I think it's not fashionable to talk the ECB up, and I try not to do it too often, but I think in this case they've been really smart in their appointment, and we'll see over the next few years whether it works. But I'm having spoken to him, I'm kind of cautiously optimistic.
How should we judge his reign by the end of it? What does a good reign as ECB chairman look like?
Well, that's a really good question. I did put that to him. He's a part of it. said being in the civil service, the key is to never be the story. And he said there's an element of that in the ECB chairmanship as well. You should not be front and center in the way that Colin Gray's often was, because he would say something like his own domestic T20 competition is mediocre, or he'd describe West Indies as mediocre before England took them on in the Test series, which the West Indies then won, I think that was the Test series. I don't think we'll be hearing those kind of things from Ian Watmore. I think it will be much more behind the scenes. He hasn't given a huge amount of interviews since he got the job. I think he says himself he's a fan of cricket, but he has to learn a lot about the game. So I think there's been a kind of certain amount of information building before he speaks to members of the press. The last question I asked him was how he should be judged. And I've just got the quote here, actually. So he referred to the ECB's Inspiring Generations 5-year strategic plan, which ECB wording is to connect communities and inspire current and future generations through cricket. So I said, how should you be judged? And he said, it sounds simple, but I think the most fundamental thing is, are we genuinely implementing the strategy, or is it still words on a page? Are we really making positive moves on that, or are we still saying, this is what we'd like to do, it's all just a bit difficult? So look, we'll see in a few years' time whether he does manage to make these things more than words on a page. But I think my impression is now that the ECB is in a pretty good place and is appointing the right people for the right jobs, something that they probably haven't done in the past.
Mm. It's a really interesting interview, and that's obviously part of the next issue of Wisden Cricket Monthly that comes out next week. We'll be talking about that in more depth next week. Ben, what's your moment of the week?
Mine was Afghanistan accidentally giving away an extra run during a test against Zimbabwe, when it was almost like an umpire's quiz question. I don't know if you saw this, Joe, when I think it was Sikander Raza, I think, was batting with the tail, and they wanted to keep him off strike, basically. And it was the last ball of the 91st over, I think. And he hit the ball out toward the point boundary, and the ball stopped like almost comically short of the rope, essentially. I mean, they could have come back for three, which would have left Raza on strike for the next over. But the fielder, as he picked up the ball, deliberately stepped across the rope as he picked up the ball in an attempt to concede four and then keep Raza off strike, which is, you know, might have thought it was being very clever, but is not allowed under the laws of the game. There's rules about the willful misfields or willful conceding of overthrows, which means that the batsmen both get the run that was completed and the boundary as well. So they got five runs rather than just four. And in the end, it barely mattered at all. They bowled them out within four balls of the next over, I think. And
this must have been a moment of high excitement for you, though, as it was unfolding, realizing the regulations at play.
Yeah, you know, it really was. Yeah, it was a. It was great. And also because a lot of people were calling it a penalty run. It wasn't really a penalty run. It's just that you get the runs in progress and then you also get the boundary. It's not like it's a 5-run penalty for fake fielding. It's just you that's how they calculate how many runs to give away in that instance.
That sounds absolutely right. I'm sort of quite impressed they've thought of that.
Mm.
that actually scenario might take place. I suppose it's not necessarily that unusual that you'd want that to happen.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, I mean, the cricket laws are very thorough, and just it's a good document to read in terms of taking care of all the eventualities.
I'm sure the cricket lawmakers. Yeah, I'm sure the cricket lawmakers will be glad to hear.
Then I'm just running the next one. Ben Gardner, Wisden says.
But just, I mean, I don't know. I mean,
a rollicking read.
This is obviously a cricket podcast and not a rugby podcast. But there was an incident in a Six Nations game recently where there was a sort of a possible knock on from one of the Welsh players. And I think it was a strange enough incident that a lot of people went to look at what the definition of a knock-on was. And it's basically doesn't exist in the rugby laws. Like, they're so unthorough. There's like a weird bit. It's like about halfway through it says principle, the game is not played by players on the floor. And it's like, how is this like a law book that you're supposed to sort of refer to and like actually decide things? And it's so much that game is down to interpretation, which it doesn't actually have to be in cricket, really.
Well, how do you know if it's deliberate or not, if he wants the ball to go to the boundary? So like if the ball is coming towards a player on the boundary and they just let it through, how do you know that's a misfield? Or
yeah, that's true.
So he could have just done it much more smartly, yeah, and he'd have got away with it.
There we go.
Well, except for the fact that if the ball had been going towards the rope and he had made a bad effort to stop it, that would have been one thing. But it's the fact that the ball stopped short.
He could have done like a trip, bit of a kick.
Yeah, that's true. Over. Yeah. Yes,
unnecessary dive and push it to the rope.
Yeah, obviously there are still debates over decisions within cricket, obviously, but it's not because of the wording of the laws, it's more because of whether someone did something deliberately or not and that sort of thing, you know, which is a better place to be in, I'd say, than, yeah.
A test match also took place between Afghanistan and Zimbabwe. Afghanistan won to level the series, but I thought the most interesting thing was that Rashid Khan bowled a 21st century record for the most overs bowled in a test match. I think it was 99 overs he bowled, which is 30 more than he's ever bowled in a single season of the IPL in one test match. And it was basically because Afghanistan only picked three bowlers. So it was...
They only picked three bowlers and then enforced the follow-on.
Yeah.
Which seems particularly hopeful. And then, unsurprisingly, Zimbabwe added like a near record eighth wicket partnership when they were all just dead on their feet and actually almost kind of won that game. Afghanistan were four wickets down when they eventually chased 100, having enforced the follow-on.
Elsewhere, South Africa completed a 4-1 series win over India in India. Lizelle Lee scored 288 runs across the series. And she now overtakes Tammy Beaumont at the top of the ODI batting rankings. So Beaumont's reign at the top wasn't particularly long. But a really good series for South Africa.
Yeah,
obviously, India haven't played that much recently, but still.
That's my favourite opening partnership to watch, possibly in all of world cricket. Lizelle Lee and Laura Woolvart, where Laura Woolvart is just cover driving every ball and then Lizelle Lee is smashing every ball over mid wicket. She's long threatened, I think, to go on a proper run, Lizelle Lee, because she can hit sixes like almost maybe Shefali Verma is the only player in world cricket who can hit them as consistently. And it's always felt like if she can just add that little bit, then she's proper world beating batter. And it looks like she's done that. So
tough gig for India, though, right? Hadn't played since the T20 World Cup final.
And in ODI cricket, not since. Mitali Raj. And Goswami were 36 the last time they played in ODI. They were both 38 this time round.
Yeah, that's a pretty tough gig.
Yeah.
Mitali Raj got 10,000 international runs now across formats, which is an impressive achievement. First woman to do that, which is amazing.
Absolutely. A bit of county cricket news that I'm just going to run through because there's quite a lot of it. So Sarah Taylor has joined the coaching staff at Sussex to work with the county's wicketkeepers. Daniel Bell Drummond has been named as Kent's vice captain, which will mean that he'll captain quite a lot, actually, because Sam Billings is at the IPL for the first 8 or 9 rounds of the county championship season. Durham have re-signed Cameron Bancroft. Scott Borthwick has been appointed the Durham captain. Andy Balburnie will deputise for Marnus Labuschagne at the beginning of the season for Glamorgan. Miguel Cummings has signed for Kent for the first 8 games of the season. Surrey have signed Kemar Roach for the first 7 games of the season. Marcus Harris will play for Leicestershire in both the County Championship and the Royal London One Day Cup. Finally, a positive, happy note to end the show on. A big congrats to Wisden's Tahar Hashim, who is obviously a regular on the show. He was commended in the ECB Domestic Journalism Awards. He was commended for the Christopher Martin Jenkins Young Journalist of the Year. So well done, Tahar, and all the other people who got awards and commendations in that. That is the end of the show. Thanks, Joe. Thanks, Ben. This has been the Wisden Cricket Weekly podcast. If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. We'll be back next week. Cheers. Podcast Network.